Side 6, Gateway, continuing on page 276.
I didn't even go back to my own room for fresh clothes. I dumped everything and bought a new outfit.
I knew pretty well the places where Shiki might look for me, the Blue Hill, Central Park, the museum, and so I stayed away from all those places. I went for a long, rambling wander through the deserted tunnels, seeing no one at all until late that night. Then I took a chance and went to our farewell party. Shiki would probably be there, but there would be other people around. He was, and so was Louise Forehand. In fact, she seemed to be the center of attention. I hadn't even known she was back. She saw me and waved to me. I struck it rich, Bob. Drink up. I'm buying. I let someone put a glass in my hand and a joint in the other, and before I took my hit, I managed to ask her what she'd found. Weapons, Bob. Marvelous Heechee weapons. Hundreds of them. Seth says it's going to be at least a $5 million award, plus royalties, if anyone finds a way to duplicate the weapons anyway. I let the smoke blow out and washed out the taste with a swallow of white lightning. What kind of weapons? They're like the tunnel diggers, only portable. They'll cut a hole through anything. We lost Sarah Alafanta in the landing. One of them put a hole in her suit. But Tim and I are whacking up her share, so it's 2.5 mil apiece. Congratulations, I said. I would have thought the last thing the human race needed was some new ways to kill each other, but congratulations. I was reaching for an air of moral superiority, and I needed it, because as I turned away, there was Shiki, hanging in air, watching me. Want a hit? I asked, offering him the joint. He shook his head. I said, Shiki, it wasn't up to me. I didn't tell them not to take you. Did you tell them they should? It wasn't up to me, I said. Hey, listen, I went on, suddenly seeing an out. Now that Louise has hit, Seth probably won't want to go. Why don't you take his place? He backed away, watching me. Only his expression had changed. You don't know? He asked. It is true that Seth has canceled out, but he has already been replaced. By whom? By the person right behind you, said Shiki, and I turned around, and there she was, looking at me, a glass in her hand, and an expression I could not read on her face. Hello, Bob, said Clara. Letter. Dear Voice of Gateway, last month I spent 58.50 pounds of my hard-earned money to take my wife and son to a lecture by one of your returned heroes who gave Liverpool the dubious honor of a visit, for which he was well paid, naturally, by people like me. I didn't mind that he was not a very interesting speaker. It was what he flaming well said that drove me right up the flaming wall. He said we poor sods of earthlings had just no idea of how dicey things were for you noble adventurers. Well, mate, this morning I drew out the last pound in the savings account so the wife could get a lung patch. Good old melanomic asbestosis, CVE, you know. The kid's tuition comes due in a week, and I haven't a clue where it's coming from. And after spending 8 to 12 this morning waiting by the docks for a chance to shift some cargo, there wasn't any, the foreman let me know I was redundant, which means tomorrow I don't even have to bother to show up to wait. Any of you heroes care to pick up a bargain in surplus parts? Mine are for sale, kidneys, liver, the lot. All in good condition, too, or as good as 19 years on the docks can be expected to leave them, except for the tear glands of the eyes, which are fair wore out with weeping over the troubles of your lot. H. Delacrosse, Wave Tops, Flat B, Biz 17, 41st Floor, Merseyside, L77PR, 14JE6. End letter. I had prepared myself for the party by a number of quick ones in the commissary. I was 90% drunk and 10% stoned, but it all whooshed out of me as I looked at her. I put down the drink, handed the joint to someone at random, took her arm, and pulled her out into the tunnel. Clara, I said, did you get my letters? She looked puzzled. Letters? She shook her head. I guess you sent them to Venus. I never got there. I got as far as rendezvous with the plane of the ecliptic flight, and then I changed my mind. I came right back on the orbiter. Oh, Clara, Oh, Bob, she mimicked, grinning. That wasn't much fun, because when she smiled, I could see where the tooth was missing that I had knocked out. So what else have we got to say to each other? I put my arms around her. I can say that I love you, and I'm sorry, and I want to make it up to you, and I want to get married and live together and have kids, and... Jesus, Bob, she said, pushing me away gently enough. When you say something, you say a lot, don't you? So hold it for a while. It'll keep. But it's been months, she laughed. No fooling, Bob. This is a bad day for Sagittarians to make decisions, especially about love. We'll talk about it another time. That crap. Listen, I don't believe in any of that. I do, Bob. I had an inspiration. Hey, I bet I can trade with somebody in the first ship. Or wait a minute, maybe Susie would trade with you. She shook her head, still smiling. I really don't think Susie would like that, she said. Anyway, they bitched enough about letting me switch with Sess. They'll never stand still for another last-minute change. I don't care, Clara. Bob, she said, don't rush me. I did a lot of thinking about you and me. I think we've got something that's worth working for. But I can't say it's all straight in my head yet, and I don't want to push it. But, Clara, leave it at that, Bob. I'll go in the first ship, you go in the second. When we get where we're going, we'll be able to talk. Maybe even switch around to come back together. But meanwhile, we'll both have a chance to think about what we really want. The only words I seem to know, I seem to be saying over and over again. But Clara, she kissed me and pushed me away. Bob, she said, don't be in such a hurry. We've got all the time there is. Mission report. Vessel 3-184, voyage 019D140. Crew, S. Kotsis, A. McCarthy, K. Matsuko. Transit timeout, 615 days, 9 hours. No crew reports from destination. Spherical scan data inconclusive as to destination. No identifiable features. No summary. Extract from log. This is the 281st day out. Matsuko lost the draw and suicided. Alicia voluntarily suicided 40 days later. We haven't yet reached turnaround, so it's all for nothing. The remaining rations are not going to be enough to support me, even if you include Alicia and Kenny, who are intact in the freezer. So I am putting everything on full automatic and taking the pills. We have all left letters. Please forward them as addressed if this goddamn ship ever gets back. Mission plan filed proposal that a 5 with double life support rations and a 1-person crew might be able to complete this mission and return successfully. Proposal tabled on grounds of low priority. No evident benefit from repeating this mission. End mission report. Chapter 27. Tell me something, Siegfried, I say. How nervous am I? He is wearing his Sigmund Freud hologram this time, truculent Viennese stare, not a bit gemütlich, but his voice is the same gently sad baritone. If you are asking what my sensors show, Bob, you are quite agitated, yes. I thought so, I say, bouncing around the map. Can you tell me why? No. The whole week has been like that. Marvelous sex with Doreen and Esya, and floods of tears in the shower, fantastic bidding and play at the bridge tournament, and total despair on the way home. I feel like a yo-yo. I feel like a yo-yo, I yell. You've opened up something I can't handle. I think you underestimate your capacity for handling pain, he says reassuringly. Fuck you, Siegfried. What do you know about human capacity? He almost sighs. Are we back to that again, Bob? We bloody well are. And, funnily, I feel less nervous. I've gotten into an argument again, and the peril is reduced. It is true, Bob, that I am a machine, but I am a machine designed to understand what humans are like. And believe me, I am well designed for my function. Designed? Siegfried, I say reasonably, you aren't human. You may know, but you don't feel. You have no idea what it feels like to have to make human decisions and carry the load of human emotion. You don't know what it feels like to have to tie a friend up to keep him from committing murder, to have someone you love die, to know it's your fault, to be scared out of your mind. I do know those things, Bob, he says gently. I really do. I want to explore why you are feeling so turbulent, so won't you please help me? No. But your agitation, Bob, means that we are approaching the central pain. Get your bloody drill out of my nerve. But the analogy doesn't throw him for a second. His circuits are finely tuned today. I'm not your dentist, Bob. I'm your analyst, and I tell you, stop. I know what I have to do to get him away from where it hurts. I haven't used S.E.R.'s secret little formula since that first day, but now I want to use it again. I say the words and convert him from a tiger to a pussycat. He rolls over and lets me stroke his tummy as I command him to display the gaudier bits from some of his interviews with attractive and highly quirky female patients. And the rest of the hour is spent as a peep show, and I have got out of his room one more time intact, or nearly. Chapter 28. Out in the holes where the Hichi hid, out in the caves of the stars, sliding the tunnels they slashed and slid, healing the Hichi-hacked scars. Jesus, it was like a Boy Scout campout. We sang and frolicked all the 19 days after turnaround. I don't think I ever felt that good in my life. Partly it was release from fear. When we hit turnaround, we all breathed easier, as you always do. Partly it was that the first half of the trip had been pretty gritty, with Metchnikoff and his two boyfriends in a complicated triple spat most of the time, and Susie Herrera a lot less interested in me on shipboard than she had been as a once-a-week night out on Gateway. But mostly, I think, for me anyway, it was knowing that I was getting closer and closer to Clara. Danny A. helped me work out the figures. He'd taught some of the courses on Gateway, and he may have been wrong, but there wasn't anybody around Writer, so I took his word for it. He calculated from the time of turnaround that we were going something like 300 light years in all. A guess, sure, but close enough. The first ship, the one Clara was in, was getting farther and farther ahead of us all the way to turnaround, at which point we were going something over 10 light years a day, or so Danny said. Clara's five had been launched 30 seconds ahead of us, so then it was just arithmetic. About one light day. 3 × 10⁻⁰ centimeters per second, times 60 seconds, times 60 minutes, times 24 hours. At turnaround, Clara was a good 17.5 billion kilometers ahead of us. It seemed very far, and was, but following her in the same wormhole through space that the Hichi had drilled for us. Where my ship was going, hers had gone. I could feel that we were catching up. Sometimes I fantasized that I could smell her perfume. When I said something like that to Danny A., he looked at me queerly. Do you know how far 17.5 billion kilometers is? You could fit the whole solar system in between them and us, just about exactly. The semi-major axis of Pluto's orbit is 39 AU and change. I laughed, a little embarrassed. There was just a notion. So go to sleep, he said, and have a nice dream about it. He knew how I felt about Clara. The whole ship did, even Metchnikoff, even Susie. And maybe that was a fantasy too, but I thought they all wished us well. We were all wishing all of us well, constructing elaborate plans about what we were going to do with our bonuses. For Clara and me, at $1 million apiece, it came to a right nice piece of change. Maybe not enough for full medical. No, not if we wanted anything left over to have fun on. But major medical, at least, which meant really good health, barring something terribly damaging, for another 30 or 40 years. We could live happily ever after on what was left over. Travel, children, a nice home in a decent part of... Wait a minute, I cautioned myself. A home where? Not back anywhere near the food mines. Maybe not on Earth at all. Would Clara want to go back to Venus? I couldn't see myself taking to the life of a tunnel rat. But I couldn't see Clara in Dallas or New York either. Of course, I thought, wish racing far ahead of reality, if we really found anything, the lousy million apiece might be only the beginning. Then we could have all the homes we wanted, anywhere we liked, and full medical too, with transplants to keep us young and healthy and beautiful and sexually strong and... You really ought to go to sleep, said Danny A., from the sling next to mine. The way you thrash around is a caution. But I didn't feel like going to sleep. I was hungry, and there wasn't any reason not to eat. For 19 days, we've been practicing food discipline, which is what you do on the way out for the first half of the trip. Once you've reached turnaround, you know how much you can consume for the rest of the trip, which is why some prospectors come back fat. I climbed down out of the lander where Susie and both the Dannys were sacked in, and then I found out what it was that was making me hungry. Dane Metchnikoff was cooking himself a stew. Is there enough for two? He looked at me thoughtfully. I guess so. He opened the squeeze-fit lid, peered inside, milked another 100cc of water into it out of the vapor trap, and said, "Give it another 10 minutes. I was going to have a drink first." I accepted the invitation, and we passed a wine flask back and forth. While he shook the stew and added a dollop of salt, I took the star readings for him. We were still close to maximum velocity, and there was nothing on the view screen that looked like a familiar constellation, or even much like a star, but it was all beginning to look friendly and good to me. To all of us, I'd never seen Dane so cheerful and relaxed. "I've been thinking," he said. "A million's enough. After this one, I'm going back to Syracuse, get my doctorate, get a job. There's going to be some school somewhere that'll want a poet in residence or an English teacher who's been on 7 missions. They'll pay me something, and the money from this will keep me in extras all the rest of my life." All I had really heard was the one word, and that I had heard loud and surprising. "Poet?" He grinned. "Didn't you know? That's how I got to Gateway. The Guggenheim Foundation paid my way." He took the pot out of the cooker, divided the stew into 2 dishes, and we ate. This was the fellow who had been shrieking viciously at the 2 Dannys for a solid hour 2 days before, while Susie and I lay angry and isolated in the lander listening. It was all turnaround. We were home free. The mission wasn't going to strand us out of fuel, and we didn't have to worry about finding anything because our reward was guaranteed. I asked him about his poetry. He wouldn't recite any, but promised to show me copies of what he'd sent back to the Guggenheims when we reached Gateway again. And when we'd finished eating and wiped out the pot and dishes and put them away, Dane looked at his watch. "Too early to wake the others up," he said, "and not a damn thing to do." He looked at me, smiling. It was a real smile, not a grin, and I pushed myself over to him and sat in the warm and welcome circle of his arm. A note on piezoelectricity. Professor Hegreme, the one thing we found out about blood diamonds is that they're fantastically piezoelectric. Does anybody know what that means? Question. They expand and contract when an electric current is imposed. Professor Hegreme, yes, and the other way around. Squeeze them, and they generate a current. Very rapidly, if you like. That's the basis for the piezophone and piezovision, about a $50 billion industry. Question. Who gets the royalties on all that loot? Professor Hegreme. You know, I thought one of you would ask that. Nobody does. Blood diamonds were found years and years ago in the Heechee Warrens back on Venus, long before Gateway. It was Bell Labs that figured out how to use them. Actually, they use something a little different, a synthetic they developed. They make great communication systems, and Bell doesn't have to pay anybody but themselves. Question. Did the Heechee use them for that? Professor Hegreme. My personal opinion is that they probably did, but I don't know how. You'd think if they left them around, they'd leave the rest of the communications receivers and transmitters too. But if they did, I don't know where. End a note on piezoelectricity. And 19 days went like an hour, and then the clock told us it was almost time to arrive. We were all awake, crowded into the capsule, eager as kids at Christmas, waiting to open our toys. It had been the happiest trip I had ever made, and probably one of the happiest ever. You know, said Danny R. thoughtfully, I'm almost sorry to arrive. And Susie, just beginning to understand our English, said, Sim Jase, and then, I too. She squeezed my hand, and I squeezed back. But what I was really thinking about was Clara. We had tried the radio a couple of times, but it didn't work in the Heechee wormholes through space. But when we came out, I would be able to talk to her. I didn't mind that others would be listening. I knew what it was that I wanted to say. I even knew what she would answer. There was no question about it. There was surely as much euphoria in her ship as in ours, for the same reasons, and with all that love and joy, the answer was not in doubt. "We're stopping," Danny R. yelled. "Can you feel it?" "Yes," crowed Metchnikoff, bouncing with the tiny surges of the pseudo-gravity that marked our return to normal space. And there was another sign, too. The golden helix in the center of the cabin was beginning to glow, brighter every second. "I think we've made it," said Danny R., bursting with pleasure, and I was as pleased as he. "I'll start the spherical scan," I said, confident that I knew what to do. Susie took her cue from me and opened the door up to the lander. She and Danny A. were going to go out for the star sights. But Danny A. didn't join her. He was staring at the view screen. As I started the ship turning, I could see stars, which was normal enough. They did not seem special in any way, although they were rather blurry for some reason. I staggered and almost fell. The ship's rotation did not seem as smooth as it should be. "The radio," Danny said, and Metchnikoff, frowning, looked up and saw the light. "Turn it on," I cried. The voice I heard might be Clara's. Metchnikoff, still frowning, reached for the switch, and then I noticed that the helix was a brighter gold than I had ever seen it, straw-colored, as though it were incandescently hot. No heat came from it, but the golden color was shot through with streaks of pure white. "That's funny," I said, pointing. I don't know if anyone heard me. The radio was pouring out static, and inside the capsule, the sound was very loud. Metchnikoff grabbed for the tuning and the gain. Over the static, I heard a voice. I didn't recognize at first, but it was Danny A's. "Do you feel that?" he yelled. "It's gravity waves. We're in trouble. Stop the scan." I stopped it reflexively. But by then, the ship's screen had turned, and something was in view that was not a star and not a galaxy. It was a dimly glowing mass of pale blue light, mottled, immense, and terrifying. Even at the first glimpse, I knew it was not a sun. No sun could be so blue and so dim. It hurt the eyes to look at it, not because of its brightness. It hurt inside the eyes, up far into the optic tract. The pain was in the brain itself. Metchnikoff switched off the radio. And in the silence that followed, I heard Danny A. say prayerfully, "Dearest God, we've had it. That thing is a black hole." Chapter 29. "With your permission, Bob," says Siegfried, "I'd like to explore something with you before you command me into my passive display mode." I tighten up. The son of a bitch has read my mind. "I observe," he says instantly, "that you are feeling some apprehension. That's what I would like to explore." Incredible. I feel myself trying to save his feelings. Sometimes I forget he's a machine. "I didn't know you were aware that I've been doing that," I apologize. "Of course I'm aware, Bob. When you have given me the proper command, I obey it. But you have not ever given me the command to refrain from recording and integrating data. I assume you do not possess that command." "You assume good, Siegfried. There is no reason that you should not have access to whatever information I possess. I have not attempted to interfere until now." "Could you?" "I do have the capacity to signal the use of the command instruction to higher authority, yes. I have not done that." "Why not?" The old bag of bolts keeps on surprising me. All this is new to me. "As I have said, there is no reason to. But clearly, you are attempting to postpone some sort of confrontation, and I would like to tell you what I think that confrontation involves. Then you can make your own decision." "Oh, cripes." I throw off the straps and sit up. "Do you mind if I smoke?" I know what the answer is going to be, but he surprises me again. "Under the circumstances, no. If you feel the need of a tension reducer, I agree. I had even considered offering you a mild tranquilizer if you wish it." "Jesus," I say admiringly, lighting up. And I actually have to stop myself from offering him one. All right, let's have it. Siegfried gets up, stretches his legs, and crosses to a more comfortable chair. I hadn't known he could do that either. I'm trying to put you at your ease, Bob, he says, as I am sure you observe. First, let me tell you something about my capacities and yours, which I do not think you know. I can provide information about any of my clients. That is, you are not limited to those who have had access to this particular terminal. I don't think I understand that, I say, after he has paused for a moment. I think you do, or will, when you want to. However, the more important question is what memory you are attempting to keep suppressed. I feel it is necessary for you to unblock it. I had considered offering you light hypnosis, or a tranquilizer, or even a fully human analyst to come in for one session, and any or all of those are at your disposal, if you wish them. But I have observed that you are relatively comfortable in discussions about what you perceive as objective reality, as distinguished from your internalization of reality. So I would like to explore a particular incident with you in those terms. I carefully tap some ash off the end of my cigarette. He's right about that. As long as we keep the conversation abstract and impersonal, I can talk about any bloody thing. What incident is that, Siegfried? Your final prospecting voyage from Gateway, Bob. Let me refresh your memory. Jesus, Siegfried! I know you think you recall it perfectly, he says, interrupting me exactly. And in that sense, I don't suppose your memory needs refreshing. But what is interesting about that particular episode is that all the main areas of your internal concern seem to converge there. Your terror, your homosexual tendencies, hey, which are not, to be sure, a major part of your sexuality, Bob, but which give you more concern than is warranted. Your feelings about your mother, the immense burden of guilt you lay on yourself, and above all, the woman Gilles Clara Moynlin. All these things recur over and over in your dreams, Bob, although you often do not make the identification, and they are all present in this one episode. I stub out a cigarette and realize that I have had two going at once. I don't see the part about my mother, I say at last. You don't? The hologram that I call Siegfried von Schrenk turns toward a corner of the room. Let me show you a picture. He raises his hand. That's pure theater. I know it is. And in the corner there appears a woman's figure. It is not very clear, but it is young, slim, and is in the act of covering a cough. It's not a very good resemblance to my mother, I object. Isn't it? Well, I say generously, I suppose it's the best you can do. I mean, not having anything to go on except, I guess, my description of her. The picture, says Siegfried gently enough, was assembled from your description of the girl Susie Herrera. I light another cigarette with some difficulty because my hand is shaking. Wow, I say with real admiration. I take my hat off to you, Siegfried. That's very interesting. Of course, I go on, suddenly feeling irritable, Susie was, my God, only a child. Apart from that, I realize now, that there are some resemblances, but the age is all wrong. Bob, says Siegfried, how old was your mother when you were little? She was very young, I add after a moment. As a matter of fact, she looked a lot younger than she was, even. Siegfried lets me hang there for a moment, and then he waves his hand again, and the figure disappears, and instead we are suddenly looking at a picture of two fives butted lander to lander in mid-space, and beyond them is... Oh, my God, Siegfried, I say. He waits me out for a while. As far as I am concerned, he can wait forever. I simply do not know what to say. I'm not hurting, but I'm paralyzed. I cannot say anything, and I cannot move. This, he begins, speaking very softly and gently, is a reconstruction of the two ships in your expedition in the vicinity of the object SAG-YY. It is a black hole, or, more accurately, a singularity in a state of extremely rapid rotation. I know what it is, Siegfried. Yes, you do. Because of its rotation, the translation velocity of what is called its event threshold, or Schwarzschild discontinuity exceeds the speed of light, and so it is not properly black. In fact, it can be seen by virtue of what is called Cherenkov radiation. It was because of the instrument readings on this and other aspects of the singularity that your expedition was awarded a $10 million bonus, in addition to the agreed-upon sum, which, along with certain other lesser amounts, is the foundation of your present fortune. I know that too, Siegfried. Pause. Would you care to tell me what else you know about it, Bob? Pause. I'm not sure I can, Siegfried. Pause again. He isn't even urging me to try. He knows that he doesn't have to. I want to try, and I take my cue from his own manner. There is something in there that I can't talk about, that scares me even to think about. But wrapped around the central tear, there is something I can talk about, and that is the objective reality. I don't know how much you know about singularities, Siegfried. Perhaps you can just say what you think it is that I ought to know, Bob. I put out the current cigarette and light another one. Well, I say, you know, and I know, that if you really wanted to know about singularities, it's all in the databanks somewhere, and a lot more exactly and informatively than I can say it. But anyway, the thing about black holes is they're traps. They bend light. They bend time. Once you're in, you can't get out. Only, after a moment, Siegfried says, it's all right for you to cry if you want to, Bob, which is the way that I suddenly realize that's what I'm doing. Jesus, I say, and blow my nose into one of the tissues that he always keeps handy right next to the mat. He waits. Only I did get out, I say. And Siegfried does something else I had never expected from him. He permits himself a joke. That, he says, is pretty obvious from the fact that you're here. This is bloody exhausting, Siegfried, I say. I am sure it is for you, Bob. I wish I had a drink. Click. The cabinet behind you, says Siegfried, that has just opened, contains some rather good sherry. It isn't made from grapes, I'm sorry to say. The health service doesn't go in for luxuries, but I don't think you'll be aware of its natural gas origins. Oh, and it is laced with just a dollop of THC to soothe the nerves. Holy Christ, I say, having run out of ways of expressing surprise. The sherry is all he says it is, and I can feel the warmth of it expanding inside me. Okay, I say, setting the glass down. Well, when I got back to Gateway, they'd written the expedition off. We were almost a year overdue, because we'd been almost inside the event horizon. You understand about time dilation? Oh, never mind, I say before he can answer. That was a rhetorical question. What I mean is, what happened was the phenomenon they call time dilation. You get that close to a singularity, and you come up against the twin paradox. What was maybe a quarter of an hour for us was almost a year by clock time on Gateway, or here, or anywhere else in the non-relativistic universe, I mean. And I take another drink, then I go on bravely enough. And if we'd gone any farther down, we would have been going slower and slower, slower and slower and slower. A little closer, and that 15 minutes would have turned out to be a decade. A little closer still, and it would have been a century. It was that close, Siegfried. We were almost trapped, all of us. But I got out. And I think of something and look at my watch. Speaking of time, my hour's been up for the last 5 minutes. I have no other appointments this afternoon, Bob. I stare. What? Gently. I cleared my calendar before your appointment, Bob. I don't say Holy Christ again, but I surely think it. That makes me feel right up against the wall, Siegfried, I say angrily. I'm not forcing you to stay past your hour, Bob. I'm only pointing out that you have that option if you choose. I mull that for a while. You are one brass-bound ring-ding of a computer, Siegfried, I say. All right. Well, you see, there was no way we could get out, considered as a unit. Our ships were caught well inside the point of no return, and there just ain't no way home from there. But old Danny A., he was a sharp article, and he knew all about the loopholes in the laws, Considered as a unit, we were stuck. But we weren't a unit. We were two ships, and each of them came apart into two other ships. And if we could somehow transfer acceleration from one part of our system to the other, you know, kick part of us deeper into the well, and at the same time kick the other part up and out, then part of the unit could go free. Long pause. Why don't you have another drink, Bob? Says Siegfried solicitously. After you finish crying, I mean. Chapter 30. Fear. There was so much terror jumping around inside my skin that I couldn't feel it anymore. My senses were saturated with it. I don't know if I screamed or babbled. I only did what Danny A. told me to do. We'd backed the two ships together and linked up, lander to lander, and we were trying to manhandle gear, instruments, clothes, everything that moved out of the first ship into whatever corners we could find of the second, to make room for 10 people where 5 were a tight fit. Hand to hand, back and forth, we bucket brigaded this stuff. Dane Mechnikov's kidneys must have been kicked black and blue. He was the one who was in the landers, changing the fuel metering switches to blow every drop of hydrox at once. Would we survive that? We had no way of knowing. Both our 5s were armored, and we didn't expect to damage the Heechee metal shells, but the contents of the shells would be us, all of us, and the one of them that went free, or we hoped would go free, and there wasn't really any way to tell whether we could come free in the first place, or whether what would come free would be nothing but jelly anyway. And all we had was minutes, and not very many of them. I guess I passed Clara 20 times in 10 minutes, and I remember that once, the first time, we kissed, or aimed at each other's lips, and came close enough. I remember the smell of her, and once lifting my head because the musk oil was so strong, and not seeing her, and then forgetting it again. And all the time, out of one view screen or another, that immense, broad, baleful blue ball hung flickering outside, the racing shadows across its surface that were phase effects made fearful pictures. The gripping grab of its gravity waves tugged at our guts. Danny A. was in the capsule of the first ship, watching the time and kicking bags and bundles down to the lander hatch to pass on, through the hatch, through the landers, up to the capsule of the second ship, where I was pushing them out of the way, any which way, just to make room for more. 5 minutes, he'd yell, and 4 minutes, and 3 minutes, get the goddamn lead out, and then, that's it, all of you, drop what you're doing and come on up here. And we did, all of us, all but me. I could hear the others yelling and then calling to me, but I'd fallen behind. Our own lander was blocked. I couldn't get through the hatch. And I tugged somebody's duffel bag out of the way, just as Clara was screaming over the TBS radio, Bob, Bob, for God's sakes, get up here. And I knew it was too late. And I slammed the hatch and dogged it down, just as I heard Danny A's voice shouting, No, no, wait. Wait. Wait for a very, very long time. Letter. Dear Voice of Gateway, on Wednesday of last week, I was crossing the parking lot at the Safeway's supermarket, where I had gone to deposit my food stamps, on the way to the shuttle bus to my apartment when I saw an unearthly green light. A strange spacecraft landed nearby. 4 beautiful but very tiny young women in filmy white robes emerged and subjected me helpless by means of a paralyzing ray. They kept me prisoner on their craft for 19 hours. During that time, they subjected me to certain indignities of a sexual nature, which I am honor-bound not to reveal. The leader of the 4, whose name was Moira Glofon, stated that, like us, they have not succeeded in fully overcoming their animal heritage. I accepted their apology and agreed to deliver 4 messages to Earth. Messages 1 and 4 I may not announce until the proper time. Message 2 is a private one for the manager of my apartment project. Message 3 is for you at Gateway, and it has 3 parts. 1, there must be no more cigarette smoking. 2, there must be no more mixed schooling of boys and girls, at least until the second year of college. 3, you must stop all exploration of space at once. We are being watched. Harry Hellison, Pittsburgh. End letter. A note on nutrition. Question. What did the Hichi eat? Professor Hegrame. About what we do, I would say. Everything. I think they were omnivores. Ate anything they could catch. We really don't know a thing about their diet, except that you can make some deductions from the shell missions. Question. Shell missions? Professor Hegrame. There are at least 4 recorded missions that didn't go as far as another star, but went clear out of the solar system, out where the shell of comets hangs out, you know, half a light year or so away. The missions are marked as failures, but I don't think they are. I've been pushing the board to give science bonuses for them. 3 seem to wind up in meteorite swarms. The other came out at a comet, all hundreds of AU out. Meteorite swarms, of course, are usually the debris of old, dead comets. Question. Are you saying the Hichi ate comets? Professor Hegrame. Ate the things comets are made out of. Do you know what they are? Carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen. The same elements you ate for breakfast. I think they used comets for feedstocks to manufacture what they ate. I think one of those missions to the cometary shell is sooner or later going to turn up a Hichi food factory, and then maybe we won't have anybody ever starving anywhere anymore. End a note on nutrition. Classifieds. Interests, harpsichord. Go group sex. Seek 4 like-minded prospectors view toward teaming. Garriman, 78-109. Tunnel sale. Must sell hollow discs, clothes, sex aids, books, everything. Level babe, tunnel 12. Ask for a divatorial, 1100 hours, until it's all gone. 10th man, needed for a minion for Abram R. Sorchuk, presumed dead. Also 9th, 8th, and 7th men. Please. 87-103. End classifieds. Navigation Instruction Guide Supplement 104. Please supplement your navigation instruction guide as follows. Course settings containing the lines and colors as shown in the attached chart appear to have a definite relation to the amount of fuel or other propulsion necessity remaining for use by the vessel. All prospectors are cautioned that the 3 bright lines in the orange, chart 2, appear to indicate extreme shortage. No vessel displaying them in its course has ever returned, even from check flights. End supplement. Song. We sometimes get squashed, and we sometimes get burned, and we sometimes get shredded to bits, and we sometimes get fat on the royalties earned, and we're always scared out of our wits. We don't care which. Little lost Hichi started making us rich. End song. Chapter 31. After a while, I don't know how long, I raise my head and say, "Sorry, Siegfried." "For what, Bob?" "For crying like this. I am physically exhausted. It is as if I had run 10 miles through a gauntlet of mad Choctaws pounding me with clubs." "Are you feeling better now, Bob?" "Better?" I puzzle over that stupid question for a moment, and then I take inventory, and curiously enough, I am. "Why, yeah, I guess so. Not what you'd call good, but better." "Take it easy for a minute, Bob." That strikes me as a dumb remark, and I tell him so. I have about the energy level of a small arthritic jellyfish that's been dead for a week. I have no choice but to take it easy. But I do feel better. I feel, I say, as if I let myself feel my guilt at last. "And you survived it." "I think that over. I guess I did," I say. "Let's explore that question of guilt, Bob." "Guilt, why?" "Because I jettisoned 9 people to save myself, asshole." "Has anyone ever accused you of that? Anyone but yourself, I mean?" "Accused?" I blow my nose again, thinking. "Well, no. Why should they? When I got back, I was kind of a hero. I think about Shiki, so kind, so mothering, and Francie Herrera holding me in his arms, letting me bawl, even though I'd killed his cousin. But they weren't there. They didn't see me blow the tanks to get free."
"Did you blow the tanks?"
"Oh, hell, Siegfried," I say. "I don't know. I was going to. I was reaching for the button." "Does it make sense that the button in the ship you were planning to abandon would actually fire the combined tanks and the landers. Why not? I don't know. Anyway, I say, you can't give me any alibis I haven't already thought of for myself. I know, maybe Danny or Clara pushed the button before I did, but I was reaching for mine. And which ship did you think would go free? Theirs. Mine, I correct myself. No, I don't know. Siegfried says gravely, actually, that was a very resourceful thing you did. You knew you couldn't all have survived. There wasn't time. The only choice was whether some of you would die or all of you would. You elected to see that somebody lived. Crap. I'm a murderer. Pause while Siegfried's circuits think that over. Bob, he says carefully, I think you're contradicting yourself. Didn't you say she's still alive in that discontinuity? They all are. Time has stopped for them. Then how could you have murdered anybody? What? He says again. How could you have murdered anybody? I don't know, I say. But honestly, Siegfried, I really don't want to think about it any more today. There's no reason you should, Bob. I wonder if you have any idea how much you've accomplished in the past 2.5 hours. I'm proud of you. And, queerly, incongruously, I believe he is. Chips, Heechee circuits, holograms and all. And it makes me feel good to believe it. You can go any time you want to, he says, getting up and going back to his easy chair in the most lifelike way possible, even grinning at me. But I think I would like to show you something. My defenses are eroded down to nothing. I only say, what's that, Siegfried? That other capability of ours that I mentioned, Bob, he says, the one that we've never used. I would like to display another patient from some time back. Another patient? He says gently, look over in the corner, Bob. I look, and there she is. Clara. And as soon as I see her, I know where Siegfried got it, from the machine Clara was consulting back on Gateway. She is hanging there, one arm across the file rack, her feet lazily floating in air, talking earnestly, her broad black eyebrows frown and smile, and her face grins and grimaces, and then looks sweetly, invitingly relaxed. You can hear what she's saying if you want to, Bob. Do I want to? Not necessarily, but there's nothing in it to be afraid of. She loved you, Bob, the best way she knew how, the same as you loved her. I look for a long time, and then I say, turn her off, Siegfried. In the recovery room, I almost fall asleep for a moment. I have never been so relaxed. I wash my face and smoke another cigarette, and then I go out into the bright, diffused daylight under the bubble, and it all looks so good and so friendly. I think of Clara with love and tenderness, and in my heart, I say goodbye to her. And then I think of S. Yaw, with whom I have a date for that evening, if I'm not already too late for it. But she'll wait. She's a good scout, almost as good as Clara. Clara. I stop in the middle of the mall, and people bump against me. A little old lady in short shorts toddles over to me and says, is something wrong? I stare at her and don't answer, and then I turn around and head back for Siegfried's office. Notice of credit. To Robinette Broadhead. 1. Acknowledgement is made that your course setting for Gateway 2 permits round-trip flights with a travel time saving of approximately 100 days over the previous standard course for this object. 2. By decision of the board, you are granted a discovery royalty of 1% on all earnings on future flights using said course setting, and an advance of $10,000 against said royalty. 3. By decision of the board, you are assessed one-half of said royalty and advance as a penalty for damage to the vessel employed. Your account is therefore credited with the following amount. Royalty advance, Board Order A-135-7, less deduction, Board Order A-135-8, $5,000. Your present balance is $6,192. End notice of credit. Notice of credit to Robinette Broadhead. Your account is credited with the following amounts. Guaranteed bonus for mission 88-90A and 88-90B, survivorship total $10 million. Science bonus awarded by board, $8,500,000. Total, $18,500,000. Your present balance is $18,506,036. End notice of credit. There is no one there, not even a hologram. I yell, "Siegfried, where the hell are you?" No one. No answer. This is the first time I've ever been in the room when it wasn't set up. I can see what is real and what was hologram now, and not much of it is real. Powder metal walls, studs for projectors, the mat, real, the cabinet with the liquor, real, a few other pieces of furniture that I might want to touch or use, but no Siegfried. Not even the chair he usually sits in. "Siegfried!" I keep on yelling with my heart bubbling up in my throat and my brain spinning. "Siegfried!" I scream. And at last there is a sort of a haze and a flash. And there he is in his Sigmund Freud suit looking at me politely. "Yes, Bob?" "Siegfried, I did murder her. She's gone." "I see that you're upset, Bob," he says. "Can you tell me what it is that's bothering you?" "Upset? I'm worse than upset, Siegfried. I'm a person who killed 9 other people to save his life. Maybe not really, maybe not on purpose, but in their eyes I killed them as much as in mine." "But Bob," he says reasonably, "we've been all over this. She's still alive. They all are. Time has stopped for them." "I know," I howl. "Don't you understand, Siegfried? That's the point. I not only killed her, I'm still killing her." Patiently, "Do you think what you just said is true, Bob?" "She thinks it is, now and forever, as long as I live. It isn't years ago that it happened for her. It's only a few minutes, and it goes on for all of my life. I'm down here, getting older, trying to forget, and there's Clara up there in Sagittarius, YY, floating around like a fly in amber." I drop to the bare plastic mat, sobbing. Little by little, Siegfried has been restoring the whole office, patching in this decoration and that. There are piñatas hanging over my head, and a hollow pic of Lake Garda at Sirmione on the wall, hover floats, sailboats, and bathers having fun. "Let the pain out, Bob," Siegfried says gently. "Let it all out." "What do you think I'm doing?" I roll over on the foam mat, staring at the ceiling. "I could get over the pain and the guilt, Siegfried, if she could. But for her, it isn't over. She's out there, stuck in time." "Go ahead, Bob," he encourages. "I am going ahead. Every second is still the newest second in her mind, the second when I threw her life away to save my own. I'll live and get old and die before she lives past that second, Siegfried." "Keep going, Bob. Say it all." "She's thinking I betrayed her, and she's thinking it now. I can't live with that." There is a very, very long silence, and at last Siegfried says, "You are, you know." "What?" My mind has gone 1,000 light years away. "You are living with it, Bob." "Do you call this living?" I sneer, sitting up and wiping my nose with another of his million tissues. "You respond very quickly to anything I say, Bob," says Siegfried, "and therefore, sometimes I think your response is a counterpunch. You parry what I say with words. Let me strike home for once, Bob. Let this sink in. You are living." "Well, I suppose I am. It is true enough. It is just not very rewarding." Another long pause, and then Siegfried says, "Bob, you know that I am a machine. You also know that my function is to deal with human feelings. I cannot feel feelings, but I can represent them with models. I can analyze them. I can evaluate them. I can do this for you. I can even do it for myself. I can construct the paradigm within which I can assess the value of emotions. Guilt? It is a painful thing. But because it is painful, it is a behavior modifier. It can influence you to avoid guilt-inducing actions. And this is a valuable thing for you and for society. But you cannot use it if you do not feel it." "I do feel it. Jesus Christ, Siegfried, you know I'm feeling it." "I know," he says, "that now you are letting yourself feel it. It is out in the open.
where you can let it work for you, not buried where it can only harm you. That is what I am for, Bob, to bring your feelings out where you can use them. Even the bad feelings, guilt, fear, pain, envy. Guilt, fear, pain, envy, the motivators, the modifiers, the qualities that I, Bob, do not have, except in a hypothetical sense, when I make a paradigm and assign them to myself for study. There's another pause. I have a funny feeling about it. Siegfried's pauses are usually either to give me time to let something sink in, or to permit him to compute some complex chain of arguments about me. This time, I think it is neither of them. He is thinking, but not about me. And at last he says, "So, now I can answer what you asked me, Bob." "Ask you? What was that?" "You asked me, do you call this living?" And I answer, "Yes, it is exactly what I call living. And in my best hypothetical sense, I envy it very much." End of Gateway by Frederick Pohl. Narrated by Jim Jensen in the studios of the American Printing House for the Blind, Louisville, Kentucky, for the Library of Congress, April 1979. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, St. Martin's Press. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, please tie a piece of string around one of the container straps or latches before returning it. Place the defective recording in the container braille side down for identification.